Hello, and welcome to Still Buffering, a cross-generational guide to the culture that made us. I am Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McRoy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
I've had an adventure, siblings.
Oh.
Tell us more.
To worst.
For Justin and I have now been married 15 years.
Wow.
That is an adventure. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That was it.
That's a long adventure.
And we're done.
Yeah.
How did you know you've reached the end?
He took me to a beer hotel, and I thought, can't get better than this.
There you go.
Quit while I'm ahead.
We are now in the happily ever after.
Yeah.
We're done. We went to this BrewDogs beer hotel in Columbus. Mm. I don't think it's called Beer Hotel, but in my head, it's called Beer Hotel.
I think it might be, though.
Is it? I know it's BrewDogs. It's like a brewery. And restaurant and beer museum and a hotel.
Wow. That's a...
So it's actually BrewDogs, brewery, restaurant, beer museum, beer hotel.
And dog park.
Okay.
Are there dogs in the dog park?
I mean, they keep them there. They don't provide dogs. Like, you have to bring your BYOD.
Not BYOB, but no. It is BYOD.
Please don't BYOB.
You didn't get like a complimentary dog with your room. Like, this is your room dog. Good boy that just chills with you while you drink beer. That would be awesome.
No, but you can bring your own dog.
Oh, and right.
Yeah, I don't have one, so I didn't bring one. I could bring my feral cat. That would have been a weird energy.
In the dog park.
I brought this cat that I can't touch because it's terrified of humans. It's also, I'm certain, terrified of dogs.
Have fun.
Just lurk around the corners of your room to make you feel a little bit at home.
Yeah. No, we got a room that overlooked the... It's the room where they keep all the barrels full of beer. So, like, I could look out my window and there were giant barrels of beer.
That's a good view.
And you dreamt about diving into them.
Mm-hmm. You can get rooms with taps in them and the rooms have, like, a shower fridge with beer.
It's perfect.
Yes. Obviously, with beer, that seems unnecessary to add. The restaurant's really good. It's all very nice. I would highly recommend it. It was such a beery good adventure.
I don't even know if that was supposed to be a bad pun.
They do axe throwing there too.
Oh, that's a good combination of things.
Yeah, that seems not the greatest idea.
I thought I had that moment where I was like, well, I've had a couple beers, time to throw an axe. Oh, this is not good.
There's a couple now axe throwing bars in New York that I have not been to yet. I sounds like something I do, but I haven't seeked them out yet.
The one, I will say that, like, it's a very controlled experience. Like, they go over safety rules and stuff with you, and it's all caged in, like a batting cage kind of thing, you know? I mean, and you have your own lane.
Yeah.
It would be very different. I mean, I'm not saying you couldn't. I'm not saying it's like, I can't see anything ever going wrong, but I mean, it's a very, like, safe, controlled experience. Yeah. And the people who showed us how to do it, they, like, walk you through how to do it right and, like, coach you and give you tips so that otherwise it would be really frustrating because it is not a natural thing. When you walk over to do it, whatever you think you're going to do, it's not that. You have to learn how to do it if you want to even, like, get the axe to stick in the board, let alone hit a bullseye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I realize now that I've done axe throwing and ninja star throwing and knife throwing at the Renaissance Fair. They always have a booth that has those three things. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely not, you're not laned off. You're like maybe, you know, 5-10 feet from the backboard, but it's not easy. I thought the hardest part would be throwing the axe. It's not. It's getting it to do anything cool.
It really took a while, and but they were very patient. I was very frustrated because I assumed for some reason, I thought, well, I'll be better at throwing an axe than Justin. And I wasn't. And that surprised and upset me. And I kept trying to, they kept working with me to try to like perfect my stance. And apparently I throw it too hard. I don't know.
You're too aggressive with the axe throwing.
Yes, I am too aggressive. So it rotated too much. So it kept bouncing off. I don't know. I tried one-handed for a while. They gave me special axe shoes because I was wearing sandals, and they were like, "Well, you can't throw an axe in sandals." So they have like special axe shoes.
Axe shoes, like bowling shoes.
They were these little black slide-ons. They were very cute, but like you have to wear these axe shoes. And they had socks. They provided socks. It was all, you know, and you had to keep the socks. So I got, you know, socks out of the deal.
Well.
But anyway, I hit one bullseye, but Justin soundly beat me. I mean, they have a number of different like games, you know, that you can play to keep score and stuff. And he completely destroyed me.
I don't know. Do you think that he's gotten in some practice down there when he's woodworking, you know, and he's just sneaky guy.
He understands. Yeah. Understands the materials.
Oh. That's what it is. I just assumed. I was like, well, obviously. If one of us, I mean, if you think about it.
I'm like sure Justin was also surprised and upset by your thought.
Yeah, I like that you just came to this conclusion. Having never thrown an axe before, I'm probably going to be good at it, though. I seem like someone that should be.
I mean, to be fair, you do.
Yeah.
If it's anything to do with, like, electronics or computers or that kind of thing, I would assume Justin would be better at it. But when it's like just like sheer brute force, throw axe at wood, I kind of figured that was my field.
Apparently not.
I don't
see. Know. I would have assumed like doctor stuff was your field, but sure.
Yeah. All that
really
too.
Sharp objects at the wall.
How are you at darts?
I'm not terrible.
Is Justin better than you at darts?
I would say we're pretty equal. We have played a lot more darts than we have thrown axes in our life. And, I would say we're pretty equal. We both, you know, they're one of those games that you play in bars that like have that natural peak where you have a couple drinks and you become amazing and then you have one too many and now it's too late.
Yeah.
Now you're very bad at darts or pool. Pool is like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like you hit that sweet spot where you're like, I am the pool master. And then it's like, oh, no.
Wait a minute.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'd say we're pretty equal.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that was my adventure.
Well,
I have nothing else to share.
Congratulations on that many years of marriage.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you.
I was 5 when you got married, and I ruined your wedding by crying the whole time.
Oh, you didn't ruin it. I felt very bad.
It is just very funny when you watch back your wedding video, you can just hear me loudly sobbing.
Well, you thought I was going to leave forever after I got married.
I thought Justin was taking you away.
Yes.
And no matter how many...
Yeah, exactly.
No matter how many times I tried to reassure you he wasn't, you kept thinking he was, and then we didn't help matters with we left for our honeymoon
at the end of the reception
the day after.
Yeah. I was like, well, there she goes.
We came back to mom and dad's house briefly to say goodbye and to see our cake smashed on the front porch. Where right. Dad dropped it
all over dad.
Dad smashed it all over himself on the front porch. It was not like a fun thing. It's an accident. Yeah. It was the red velvet layer too. It was just everywhere. Yeah.
It looked like there was murder on the front porch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just too many drinks. He had already done the I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt dance in front of everyone.
Mom got in the fountain.
No one was ready to carry that cake.
Great time. Great time. I didn't eat or drink anything. That's all I remember is at the end of the wedding, Justin and I were both like, God, we're so hungry. Why? There was so much food. Why didn't we get any?
Too busy getting married.
I was just so busy getting married.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of love stories.
Oh,
look at that.
That's a good transition. Yeah. We're talking about Moulin Rouge this week.
Ooh.
Taylor, you've chosen Moulin Rouge for us to discuss. Why was this your pick?
Why wouldn't it be? It's a movie musical. It's a jukebox musical from 2001 by Baz Luhrmann. It is like eye candy, just like bright colors, beautiful costumes, like cool dance routines, fun songs. It's just a visual feast, and that is very much up my alley.
Do you feel like it's funny because of the like of the movies of that time period, I would have chosen like Romeo and Juliet as the one that was more culturally significant to me. Not necessarily better, just like the one that I latched on to. Do you feel like Moulin Rouge was that for you?
I think so, yeah. Because I don't know. I mean, Romeo and Juliet was very... it's the same director, and it had a similar aesthetic, but I feel like Moulin Rouge was kind of turning it up to, like, the 10th degree. And it's also a fantasy to a certain degree. You know, it's like... Mm-hmm. It's not any less... I mean, it's... I guess it's somewhat less of a sad ending, but it's still just such a... Just a, like, cartoon in live action.
It really is.
It was part of... Did you know that this is part of the Red Curtain trilogy?
Yeah.
I didn't know this.
With Strictly Ballroom.
And then, yeah, and Romeo and Juliet.
And they each kind of centered around a different focus. So this was song, and Strictly Ballroom was dance, and I guess Romeo and Juliet is poetry.
Theater.
Oh.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I didn't know that until I was looking into Moulin Rouge, because I hadn't... I mean, I love the movie. I've seen it. I hadn't really, like, researched. You know how when you love a movie, you then do research on it?
I mean, I do.
Yeah.
I'm that person that if you're watching a movie with, I'll be sitting there on my phone like, oh, we saw them in that movie. Oh, we also saw them in that TV show. Oh, did you see that one? They were in that one, too. Do you know the same guy directed this one?
I don't do that. The only thing I do is, like, I'm currently reading every article that I can find about what's going to happen on Loki because I'm worried.
Yeah.
I'm so into it, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm so invested that I'm, like, anything about, like, theories. I'm like, what do you think? Oh, I hope you're wrong.
That is why I only watch shows that either all the episodes are already out or I've already seen 1,000 times. Don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that's...
No, it's going
to
happen.
Usually I wait till the whole thing's done to watch it, because even if I get, like, if it's all there, even if I'm, like, halfway through and I'm just feeling too tense about it, I'll look up spoilers just so I know I'm not going in a bad direction. So watching Loki as the episodes come out, which is what I'm doing right now, is very stressful for me.
That is one advantage of seeing Moulin Rouge again, is that I already knew it was going to happen, so I didn't have to worry about it. I know it's sad. It's supposed to be beautiful. It's one of those things where I think, like, as a young person, I was similar to Romeo and Juliet. I was probably like, oh, I know. And this is a spoiler. We're going to spoil Moulin Rouge if you haven't seen it.
I mean, he says in the first, like, minute of the movie, my love is dead.
Yeah. Well,
Satine is dead.
So she dies.
Yeah.
But I think when I watched it as a young person, I was like, what a romantic, beautiful, sweeping love story where one of the two people die.
Yeah.
And, like, now as an adult, I'm like, well, that's a total bummer. It's still a beautiful movie, though.
Yeah. Well, it's like the brief outline of the plot, for those that don't know, is there's a set in Paris and what is this, like the 1920s or earlier?
No, it's the end of the 1800s.
That's right.
Yeah, because...
1899 into 1900.
Because I believe Toulouse-Lautrec actually died in 1901, so it would have been right before the end of...
That's what he said in the beginning. It starts in the summer of 1899.
Is that okay?
They talk about celebrating the end of the century.
The end of the century, yeah.
Well, there's a young writer, Christian, who's new to the city, and he falls in love with the star of the Moulin Rouge dance club. And,
Dance club.
Brothel, dance party... eventual theater. I don't know. It's a lot of things. It seems
cabaret.
Like. Sure. Yeah.
Cabaret.
But yeah, that there's like a rich guy that is also vying for her and trying to basically own her, and
a duke.
Yes.
He's a duke.
And they eventually love wins, but then unfortunately Satine, the young woman, is
that's not
afflicted by tuberculosis, and she passes away at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The most romantic of deaths.
Right.
Yeah. That was, I appreciated that attention to detail, because it really was using her death from tuberculosis as this sort of beautiful romantic centerpiece was so typical for that time. Because it was thought of as the most romantic of deaths. Of all the, like, terrible chronic bacterial lung infections you could get, it was way up there, you know, in terms of romance.
Right.
And so I like that they put that there.
Yeah. Can I ask, just, like, as a small detail, that throughout the film, only, like, two people know that she's dying of tuberculosis. Henry Ziedler, like, the owner, and then... the woman who helps all the dancers. I don't quite know who
she's the, like the madam of the. Okay, yeah. Right? Okay. Isn't that her role? Sort of like the mother figure for all of the performers and dancers and sex workers that work at the Moulin Rouge.
Okay. But they're the only ones that know, and she's constantly giving Satine something, like a powder. What is that? Because like at the very end, they're doing that final on opening night, they're doing the performance of their show, and she's struggling backstage, and she says, "Here, just a little bit more," and like dumps some powder in her mouth.
I think it was a liquid. I assumed it was like opium or something.
At the time, laudanum, a form of opium, mm-hmm. would have been the most likely thing. Like, just not because it did anything, but because felt better. And, you know, any opiates would suppress the cough. Mm-hmm. So you might think it was doing something because you don't cough as much. So I would say it was probably something like that.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Entering slight Sawbones territory. I was just curious the whole time. Like, what does she do? What are they doing?
At one point, what she uses is straight up smelling salts just to revive
her. Just to wake her up.
Yeah. But yeah, I think like it. My guess is that she's giving her opium.
Okay. That makes sense.
That would have been very typical.
I mean, not in today's, but you know.
No, that is, we actually don't, we don't treat tuberculosis with opium anymore.
Mm.
We have medicine that works.
Right.
That treats it. So that's good. It's a shame the movie wasn't set now.
Really?
Because she would have just gone to a doctor, gotten an x-ray, gotten some medicine. Much less sweeping, perhaps.
Right.
But I like endings where everybody lives, so. The thing about this movie that resonated most with me, Tay, in terms of, like, from our youth to now, is as we were watching it now, it occurred to me how many times I listened to the soundtrack.
Yeah, that was definitely on heavy rotation. That CD was on heavy rotation in your car, mom's car. Mm-hmm. My God,
I was obsessed with it. And all of the songs, not just like everybody. I think when you think of Moulin Rouge, you think of Lady Marmalade. That's like the song that sort of, because the music video came out and it was huge. And, you know, that sort of typified the movie. But like, as I was watching, like that whole frickin' soundtrack I listened to.
Yeah.
Except for Roxanne. I used to skip Roxanne a lot.
Oh, I got into that one.
It used to upset me.
When that came on, like the whole big group dance, maybe that's why I liked it. It's like, oh, it's a big choreographed number.
Well, it's a pretty number. And like the Ewan McGregor part over top of, I mean, it's all a beautiful arrangement. But I think I found I found it a little too raw to listen to on a CD.
but the Elephant Love medley was always my favorite on the CD. I think that's that was a standout for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. How there is a certain age of people who have that entire thing memorized and periodically are just, you know, kind of in their head doing it.
Right.
Just like going through that. Like,
I did tell you all before we started that version of Lady Marmalade, that's Christina Aguilera, was the only one I thought existed for a long time, because I've seen this movie, I think, once in my life, some in my distant memory. And for some reason, that is the one song that I remember, and also the only version of that song I thought existed. I thought it was a Christina Aguilera song.
It's so weird culturally, because when that came out, I mean, it's Christina Aguilera, but it's also Pink, it's Maya, Lil' Kim. And it was such a big deal that, wow, there's like four divas that are performing in the same song together, coexisting in the same space. Like, so we were just so broken in our perception of women entertainers. Like, oh, wow. Like, they're all going to fight probably, right?
Well, and stories came out like that, right? Because I remember, and I don't know if any of this is true, like some sort of story about like Christina's manager coming in and being like, what's the biggest part? That's Christina's. Wow. That's the one she's going to get. I remember these, like, and I mean, they may all be fake, but there were like all these stories about them like fighting over the biggest role and all this. And I mean, you know, who knows? Probably all of it was made up.
But yeah, the soundtrack is wonderful. And I, you know, you called it a jukebox musical, which it is. And I hadn't even thought of it that way. But this was before, Mamma Mia, obviously. Like, was this like one of the first, probably like definite jukebox musicals. I don't want to say the first because I don't know.
Well, I certainly don't think movies were being made like this at the moment, like many of them.
Yeah, because Mamma Mia was predates it on as like as a show, right? It's not a movie.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
I thought the musical. Well, never mind.
But as a, but I mean, you know, I it was one of those like movie musicals go away periodically, and then everybody remembers like we're all trying to be cool, but we're cheesy. We love, we love when people break out into song. Like don't front, you love it. Everybody does. We all pretend like, well, it's a musical.
Everybody went wild for La La Land.
We love that stuff. We love when it's like, well, it doesn't make sense, but they sound so good.
Yeah.
I do think it was one of the first successful, like, of this kind in a long time in movie format. Like, I do think that hadn't been a thing. I read it. There was another article about it. It was talking about some of the other movie musicals that had flopped leading up to Moulin Rouge, that it was kind of a bit of a reset for that, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess it also strikes me as different because most other jukebox musicals that I'm culturally aware of, and obviously I have no concept of time about when any of them existed, are like one artist or like one group. I mean, like Mamma Mia is all ABBA or whatever, you know. But this is obviously not. This is just like so many songs, so many groups, and also so many different like genres and feels, and I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that took forever to get permission.
Oh, yeah.
It was apparently held up for like a year in just like licensing, getting all of those, all the various songs. And there were some songs that were kind of built into it that ultimately they couldn't get. So they had to sub in other things.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I wonder what was in there they had to get rid of.
I know.
Find it.
I want to talk more about the music and the story itself. But before we do that,
let's check the group message.
Oh, it's that time of the week again where I get to tell my siblings about my pants.
Oh, boy.
This is my favorite thing to do. Do you know why I love telling you about my pants?
Why?
Because it's really hard to get ready for a work day and know, like, I've got a long day ahead of me and I'm going to be really busy and on my feet all day and moving around. And then I've got, you know, maybe to get home and get the girls to stuff or get to meetings, or maybe I'm going to go out to dinner later and I need pants that get me through the whole day. And Beta Brand dress pant yoga pants are exactly those pants. They are dress pants. So they look stylish. They look professional. You look put together. You don't look like you're wearing something as comfortable as you secretly are because they feel like yoga pants. They are functional, they're comfortable, they are as inspiring as your favorite workout gear, but they're not. They're dress pants, so you can, you know, have that little secret all day long. They're wrinkle resistant, stretch knit fabric. Beta Brand dress pant yoga pants, really, I've been wearing them for a long time. They're perfect for, I mean, lots of different genres of work, but especially in my doctor job, in my side gig, as it were. being able to move around and, like, you know, get down and check out patients' feet if I need to, and you know, whatever I need to do in my clothes, and not have to worry about, like, is this getting all wrinkly? Do I look less professional now? It's really a wonderful thing to just take that off my mind and know all day long I'm going to look great, I'm going to feel great. And I can't recommend Beta Brand dress pant yoga pants enough. So, Taylor, if our listeners want to check them out, what should they do?
Right now, our listeners can get 25% off their first order when you go to betabrand.com/buffering. That's 25% off your first order for a limited time at betabrand.com/buffering. Find out why people are ditching typical work pants for Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants. Go to betabrand.com/buffering for 25% off.
So your favorite time of week is when you get to tell your siblings about your pants. I love getting to tell my siblings about my pits.
Ooh.
My armpits, that is. And what goes in them.
in your armpits,
well,
Riley?
Let me tell you. We've told you before about Native's legendary deodorant, so you probably already know all about that. We've talked about that a lot for a long time now here on Still Buff. But did you know now they have body wash, toothpaste, and brand new mineral-based sunscreen for you to use all over your body, not just the pits?
Well, I did. I got some of the body wash, and I've been using that. Charlie got really jealous. She's been using it, too, and so, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Now Native's got you covered other places. And their newest addition is their broad spectrum SPF 30 sunscreen for your face and body. It's lightweight, absorbs quickly, and you can choose between unscented or coconut and pineapple, which sounds delightful because I don't know about you all, but I love summer scents like sunscreen. So summer scents added to my sunscreen, that just puts me in the island time mindset.
Now you're tropical and protected from the sun.
Yes, tropical and my skin is safe. But just like Charlie, I've been also using their body wash. I have one of their summer scents, their surf and sea foam.
Mm-hmm.
Smells delightful. And you can get their deodorant and body wash in other amazing scents like coconut, vanilla, citrus and herbal musk, lavender, rose, and many more. So, Tay, if our listeners want to check out Native, what should they do?
Stay fresh, stay clean with Native by going to nativedeo.com/buffering or use promo code buffering at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/buffering or use promo code buffering at checkout for 20% off your first order.
One thing I was reading about like the different inspirations for the movie is that the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Mm-hmm.
Was part of the inspiration, which is why they chose to use modern songs, because Orpheus was supposed to be so talented that his music was ahead of its time. It felt like something from the future. So they are literally using songs from the future throughout.
Interesting.
Which is why, like, if you know in that context, the moment that he breaks into The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music at the very beginning makes a lot more sense. Because at first you're just like, who is this guy that they're saying wrote Sound of Music?
Yeah.
I don't think that's right. Oh, okay. He's ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Apparently the Rolling Stones, just to get back to, I couldn't figure out what those songs, the Rolling Stones refused to have any of their music in it. And Cat Stevens' Father and Son was what the opening was built around. So they had to rewrite the opening completely to have a different scene.
Wow. Interesting.
And it took him 2.5 years to secure the rights.
Oh, my gosh.
That's wild.
There's a lot of songs in there.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a lot of good music. I read that this was very interesting. We were looking at people who auditioned for roles or were considered for roles and then didn't get them. Courtney Love auditioned for the lead, Satine, and didn't get it, of course, because Nicole Kidman played it. So you probably already knew that. But
what
allowed them to use Smells Like Teen Spirit in the movie anyway?
Mm-hmm. Who did you say had auditioned for Christian?
For Christian, I know Leo did, Leonardo DiCaprio, which I assume was because he was in
Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, and so Baz Luhrmann considered him for this.
Yeah,
too.
But apparently he couldn't sing, and he that was
is that,
that
right?
Was his take on it was that he couldn't sing as well, so that's why.
I didn't know. That was my guess, was maybe it was a singing thing.
Yeah.
That Ewan McGregor isn't great, but like, it's Leo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Why was he passed over?
Well, especially if it's supposed to be in the same sort of like trilogy of movies as Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been kind of a bummer though, because it's like, wait, did Jack live and now he's over here wooing some girl in Paris?
In France?
How'd he get there?
Rose is waiting for you, man.
Yeah, there was a, there was somebody else of note that auditioned for that role. Oh, I'll think of it before this is over. I wondered, I had to imagine Ewan McGregor's singing ability was part of, I mean, again, not that he isn't a great actor, but like, he is a good singer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very good singer. And I feel like they did the thing. I think I have thought this about Mamma Mia before, the movie. Mm-hmm. They did the thing where they cast people who could sing but aren't professional singers. And I feel like that adds this sort of earnestness to the characters and like realism that is kind of beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
When like there are moments where, you know, like somebody who is trained and has spent their entire life singing would probably sound a little better at that note or that whatever. But instead the actor's doing it and it feels more real.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was sort of my feeling on it.
I definitely felt that with Nicole Kidman too. Like I think, I love her voice in this movie. I think it's beautiful, but it's not a professional voice. I feel like it sounds very much in character with the role she's playing, and like they kind of wrote around her range.
Yeah. yeah, it does make them feel more in character. I mean, he's a writer. He wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't necessarily be this trained singer.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a performer, but she's not a, well, I guess she sings in her performances, but not like a, you know, classical professional way. So I do think it adds to putting you in the scene.
Jake Gyllenhaal. That's who it was.
Oh. Oh,
I could see that.
Interesting.
I know. I mean, and that's all I can imagine is, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it just came down to, maybe they had a sing-off. Can you imagine that moment?
Ewan McGregor versus Jake Gyllenhaal?
And Leonardo
and
DiCaprio.
And Leonardo DiCaprio. All three on stage having to like sing, like it's a high school audition for like the musical. And they like had Nicole Kidman come up and like stand with each one.
Yeah.
Like, we know it's Nicole. But we can't decide.
Yeah.
Jake, Leo, or Ewan. Let's have you all come out here and let's check out your chemistry.
It is really hard for me to imagine anyone else other than Nicole Kidman in that role.
She's so perfect in this role. She's,
I know.
I love her so much in this movie. That scene, the scene where they're in the elephant and she's trying to distract the Duke from Christian's presence in the room. So she's just doing this whole like going back and forth of being like super sexy to like completely like this is just Looney Tunes straight up like silliness. And it's like she's just living in every moment of that. I love that scene so much.
Like right before when she thinks Christian is the Duke and he's talking about poetry and she thinks this is like his way of like seduction. So she's trying to be all sexy and is rolling around on the ground and wrapping herself up in the rug like that. I was rolling in tears. Oh, my gosh.
The farce of that whole scene is really well done. I was impressed watching it again. Like when he starts saying like she's like come lay down and he's like I prefer to stand and she's like oh okay and he's like no but you sit okay what I do is really quite modern okay like the whole thing is very it's really well done.
I
was impressed with how funny some bits of it are and how she leans into that. She does well with that. So she doesn't just seem like swooning and you know swooning and sultry as the two modes. Like it's not just that for the character. But the big scene at the end with Come What May, that I feel like it should, I have seen this movie repeatedly and it should not still affect me, that scene. You know what I mean? Like when they're in the show and they're all singing and they have the big finale, like it should not still be that impactful. And it really is, which is impressive.
I cried.
You cried.
I cried.
Aww.
I don't know. I just like, again, I obviously know she dies and like the song is in the movie before then. So it's not like it's like a shock of like, oh, this song. So it just, I don't know. It hit me.
Just really gotcha.
It really got me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's doing everything it can to get you, to be fair. Like there is beautiful visuals, you know, the swell of the song and the chorus, two lovers crying at each other. Doing everything it can.
That last minute of Spectacular where they have like the big colorful like heart-shaped backdrop and they're lifting them up and they have like the colorful lights and confetti or whatever is going on, like it was just like so much. It was so pretty. It looked like a painting. It didn't look like actually moving parts.
Well, I think that's the aesthetics of the film, I think, for the thing that's most impactful for me, because that's very much like I'm not for one for restraint with color or detail in any of my work. So this is like every scene in this movie is just like, just pause it and just look at the screen. There's so much happening.
There were moments where this struck me as similar to like a Wes Anderson movie. Like the shooting of like how some of the movements and some of the clips are almost like very quick and jerking between like two different scenes.
Yeah, the cuts are very fast.
Characters' movements or like the way they talk to each other, where sometimes it almost looks like they're like lip syncing their own voices, if that makes sense. And it looks very like cartoonish, but real life. And then those bright colors and those scenes where it looks like a picture, it doesn't look like actually people in it, struck me as very Wes Anderson, which I also enjoy those movies. I know it's not, but
I wonder if they draw inspiration from each other, you know? Which again, I don't know. I always feel like this calls to like our own turn of the century sort of aesthetic, where these movies sort of live and where Moulin Rouge takes place at the turn of a different century.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, 2001, it was, there's a lot of hope, I think, when you enter into a new you know, century, decade. It's like, oh, fresh start. And I feel like there's a lot of hope in this movie. I had that thought, like, God, would it hit me the same now? Would it even get made now? Because it's so, like, just love and freedom and beauty. It's
like, yeah, truth.
Yeah. And the decadence.
It's a little bit Rent, too, right?
It was partially inspired by La Boheme.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, you can't, and like, you have to read that into it with the, I've moved to Paris to be poor.
Yeah.
I moved to Paris to live with a bunch of people in a loft and be poor together.
Yes. It's Rent.
It's Rent.
Yeah.
Just sub New York with Paris.
It does make me wonder, though, how the musical just premiered like shortly before everything got shut down. I never saw it, but it makes me wonder how similar and how much the same or how different it is, that it is almost being like remade today. Mm-hmm. I know it's, you know, still the same story and everything, but it makes me wonder how much of it has changed for a modern audience.
I don't know. I mean, assuming that you could translate all the rights, I don't know how that,
right.
I imagine that's a whole other process to get the rights for the songs again.
This
for this
years
new
later
media, yeah.
A musical.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that's a whole thing, but assuming you could, I don't know why. There's so many great songs, especially that ending number, that I feel like, why touch?
Oh, yeah.
Why change a thing?
Well, and so much of it looks like it's just out of a musical. I mean, the big dance numbers from the beginning to Roxanne and the end. I mean, it mm-hmm. looks like it's just made to be on a stage. It doesn't seem like that much of it would even... you'd want to change.
Apparently there are other songs in the musical. Ooh. There are other,
really,
yeah, like more jukebox styles, like not right. original songs, other pop songs. But
interesting.
It is cool though, because it's sort of that at the turn of the century, instead of that, you have all this sort of like people partying, which can so often be associated with like the decadence that we're saying goodbye to, which is like the theme of so many of those sorts of stories, because they're all like drunk and, you know, on absinthe and, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. And they're all partying, and it's supposed to be this sort of like, can you believe how decadent all this is? But instead, it's really presented as like, this is the new world. It's full of love. It's full of beauty and acceptance. And this, like, it's okay. Everything we're doing right now is okay because we love each other and we're doing it in the spirit of truth and beauty and mm-hmm. honest, you know, and all that kind of stuff, which is a really hopeful kind of message, even though it does still end really sad with him and his sad hat and typewriter.
Sad hat. I'm going to put on my sad hat and write.
Sad hat, the sad beard he's grown.
Yeah.
He's got the sad beard and the sad hat, and his typewriter shouldn't be sad, but now it feels sad.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, you know, there is something to be the fact that he finds his motivation to be a writer at the sacrifice of you know, the woman is a little bit of a woman in a refrigerator moment, I think it's worth noting.
This is true.
I will say I do love a movie where the story being told is like the story that it ends with, like Little Women, you know, like it's,
you like that?
It ends with Joe writing Little Women, and that's the story. Like, I do like that. Like, oh, okay, it's his story. That's why, because then you understand, like, we're seeing this through his lens. This is his version. It's his story of what has happened,
like Edward Scissorhands.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
This movie also made me fascinated with absinthe for a while.
Do you think it was going to make a fairy start singing the Sound of Music?
Kylie Minogue a little here before you.
Exactly. I thought a little green Kylie Minogue would show up and everything would get really colorful and magical and and musical, but that is not what happened the first time I drank absinthe. It's just like regular drunk.
Yeah. Might be a little worse.
I mean, I don't know. Actually, Taylor, maybe you've had a different experience, but I mean, in my limited experience with absinthe, it was like, well, that was just booze.
No, there's no, that's been disproven. There's no hallucinogenic properties to absinthe. But it is very alcoholic and you know, like, usually served with a lot of sugar, so it can be a bad hangover. You know, that part was originally, they considered not having Kylie Minogue, but having like a different representation of the Green Fairy that was like a big muscly beard guy, and it's gonna be voiced by Ozzy Osbourne.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
I can see for the commercial appeal of having Kylie Minogue in there, but I kind of wish we would have gotten big, like, metalhead Green Fairy, because I think that's my experience with Absinthe.
Yeah, I would say that was definitely more the trip that I took.
Yeah, yeah. Just like, oh, I just beaten with Absinthe.
The first time I ever tried Absinthe, I was in Prague because it was still illegal in the U.S. at the time. Do you remember that? You couldn't get Absinthe in the U.S.?
Yeah, no, it's fairly recent. I mean, in the last, like, two decades, maybe, but I think it's only in the 2000s it's been legalized.
My friends and I thought we were being quite bad.
Right.
And when they bring you the absinthe and it's like, here's a sugar cube and a spoon and a lighter and a glass of absinthe, and you're looking at this on the table going, I don't know what I got. Because I didn't know how to drink. I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
I think my reference was probably Moulin Rouge. So I'm like, what? We're all just sitting there looking at it. And the very frustrated bartender is like, probably like, Americans.
Yeah.
And showed us how to do it. And it was like, oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, you're putting it into solution. Okay. Fascinating.
The whole combination of like high octane spirit plus open flame is really the really not a great combination for young, like, would-be underage tourists, I think. But, you know, that is the indoctrination most people get.
Yes, because I mean, I think it would have been much more romantic, which I imagine is what they had in Moulin Rouge, which was one of those, like, dripper things that slowly drips it down over the sugar cube and dissolves slowly over the spoon and the lighter. But,
yeah.
But it worked.
Yeah.
And that was that. Anyway, there's no Green Fairy. No. That's the point.
The only question I had watching this movie was towards the end when it's opening night and Christian has shown up to, you know, be heartbroken.
Yes.
And
he has shown up to be heartbroken.
I mean, that's kind of what he did.
That is such a boy in a movie, especially like in the 90s into the 2000s move. I've shown up to be heartbroken.
He's shown up to mess with Satine's opening night to make it all about how sad he is.
I have an emotion.
I'm making it about me.
Yeah. But the Duke's bodyguard or whoever is back there, and the Duke sees him and is like, okay, kill him. He's here. And I'm watching it the whole time like, what was his plan? He has told this guy to murder this man in front of an audience of like hundreds of people and a cast of another like 100. It's a big cast, like 100 people in there. What is his next move here?
He's a Duke.
Yeah, he can get away with it.
Of where?
Of
the Moulin Rouge?
Of Paris.
Somewhere.
I don't know.
What power does he have?
A lot of random royalty running around back then, you know, just some random land claim.
I mean, I was wondering, like, so, what is he going to do? Because then the Duke tries to kill him, too. It's like, what is your plan, bud?
He's a Duke, but he's probably from the UK, right?
Yeah.
Is that our thought? Like, he's not French.
He doesn't have a French accent, does he? No.
No. No one.
But nobody.
No one does. I don't know. They're all kind of British?
Well, Ewan McGregor just sounds like Ewan McGregor.
Well, yeah. And he says that he came from London.
Yes.
But Nicole Kidman, I thought we were to assume was French.
Her name is Satine. We think. I mean, she might just go by Satine.
But she also is kind of British at times.
Sometimes the Australian comes through.
Yeah. I don't know what anyone is.
Which is no shade. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I like it. I don't know. It's a fantasy.
Yeah.
My take is that he was like a British Duke. But like all of them were related back then, right? Like weren't all the royalty from all the places were all sort of connected.
Yeah.
Kind of family.
It's
about family. See, this is the Fast and Furious Moulin Rouge. It's all about family.
My theory is that the Duke of Wesselton from Frozen was based on this Duke.
I could see that.
And is maybe the same Duke. Frozen was probably around that time, right? And set around that time? I don't know.
Yeah, they...
I don't know. That's,
they both have the same mustache. Yeah,
they are similar characters. That is true.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. We've cracked it wide open. You knew Disney was up in this.
He is the Duke of Wesselton. That is what he's the Duke of.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
My only reference for a Duke right now is Bridgerton, and that's a different...
That's different.
That's a different Duke.
I usually do not like bad guys in movies. I don't know. I like good guys, but I love the Duke in this movie. I think he's the right blend of, like, he's a bad dude, but, like, he's also so, like, he's not very sharp. Like, he's kind of a cartoon character himself. He's just, like, you know, like a bad guy from a cartoon, which is enjoyable because he's very funny too. The actor does a good job.
Yeah.
Well, it was, I say all in all, it was enjoyable to watch again because it'd been a while.
Yeah.
Not one that the kids are ready for, but
sure.
But I did enjoy it, and I'm glad that you suggested we watch it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for watching it.
Well, of course.
Thank you for reintroducing me to it. It had been so long. Yeah. But it was so enjoyable.
I am going to listen to the soundtrack more now.
Me too.
Now that I've thought about it again.
I had it.
And check out the musical soundtrack.
Yeah, I'm really curious. I don't know the full extent, but I saw that they were talking about getting, like, Torn in there.
Oh my god. I gotta come visit you, Tay, so you can see Moulin Rouge the musical.
I know.
It opens back up in September.
Okay, we got some time.
We're there.
Mm-hmm. We're there.
It's a plan.
All right, Riley, what's next?
So, speaking of modern music, I want to talk about Harry Styles.
Ooh.
I don't know how I have yet to talk about Harry Styles. He's also connected to Taylor Swift, of course, but also he just makes great music and seems to be a very important cultural moment for the Gen Z youths.
Experience.
Let's talk about this important cultural moment that is a human named Harry Styles.
He came from a boy band, and now he's just a boy. And he is...
There was a moment. Boy. It was named Harry Styles.
He'd be great, by the way.
Oh, he'd be great as Christian.
In this. Yes.
Very much a boy with an emotion.
Yes. Yeah.
He would be great as Christian.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out there.
Okay. But yeah, Harry Styles, Fine Line was his most recent album. So we'll talk about that. Maybe a little bit of One Direction too, but because he was in that.
Oh, I know that.
Just making sure.
I know these things. I appreciate Harry Styles.
Well, thank you, Tay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tay. Thank you, listeners. I hope if you haven't watched Moulin Rouge, what are you doing? Like, go watch it. Get that soundtrack. Thank you to Maximum Fun. You should go to MaximumFun.org and check out all the great podcasts that are there. You can tweet at us at StillBuff. You can email us at StillBuffering@MaximumFun.org. for thoughts or suggestions or questions or comments or topics or anything. And thank you to the Novellas for our theme song, Baby Change Mine.
This has been your cross-generational guide to the culture that made us. I am Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McRoy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
I am Still Buffering.
And
I am too.
I think it's just the part where he goes, Roxanne.
I love that part.
It's that part.
I get into it.
It scared me when I was young.
Well, honey.
It's very dark.
It's very growly.
Schmanners. Noun. Definition. Rules of etiquette designed not to judge others, but rather to guide ourselves through everyday social situations.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband host, Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife host, Teresa McElroy.
Every week on Schmanners, we take a look at a topic that has to do with society or manners. We talk about the history of it. We take a look at how it applies to everyday life. And we take some of your questions. And sometimes we do a biography about a really cool person that had an impact on how we view etiquette. So join us every Friday and listen to Schmanners on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
Manners, schmanners. Get it?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.